part of the genius of St. Paul, and the genius is kind of epitomized in this last document, as far as we know, that except before he was killed, the letter to the Romans. As he was able to take, you know, that buzzing, blooming reality of the Christian life and discern patterns and give large meanings to us. He had a great power of insight and abstraction and building this massive theological system, if you will. Always, the beauty of Paul, though, however, is he never lost his rootage in the lived reality of this stuff. So he was able to do that wonderful combination of things, namely achieved the life, the examined life, and the life really lived. So we're at something of a disadvantage when we jump into the middle of the letter to the Romans, as we have been the last few Sundays, where we get all this highly abstract talk. We were baptized. Are you unaware that we who were baptized into Christ Jesus were baptized into his death? Now look at that statement from him. On the face of it, it means virtually nothing. I mean, it's goofy. I mean, it sounds kind of nice, and you maybe get some sort of pious resonances out of it. But basically, it doesn't fizz. So our job is to try to figure out what in blazes he's talking about. What does it mean to be baptized into the death of Jesus? I'm not just talking about the crucifixion. This is very clear, as Paul says all over the place, especially in the Corinthian letters, that death is a constant of the Christian life, a daily event. Find echoes of that in this business of taking up the cross and following. So I'd just like to play this thing from the Romans off against the passage from Matthew, to see what we can tease out of that in terms of making sense of that highly abstract notion of being baptized into the death of Christ Jesus. And Matthew hits us head on with a major instance of that. Whoever loves father or mother, children, more than me is not worthy of me. That's ferocious language. Because children have their very sense of who they are out of that bond. And often enough, parents are only who they are because they are the parents of. So we're hitting right at the very heart of the normal way we identify ourselves. I am who I am. Who are you? I'm the son of. I'm the father of. And what Jesus is saying is that no, that if that's the foundational reality of who you are and of the way you put the world together, you're not going to make it in this Christian business. This, I think, to borrow the title of a book, a text of terror. I really think it scares me. If I seriously look at the way I construct my life. But we can say, and that's a kind of death. Especially in first century Palestine, family, clan relationships were even more important than they are today to us. I mean, I remember being horrified when I was the chaplain at King's and doing a fair amount of counseling, where kids would routinely come in and say they hated their parents. Now, they were a generation or so beyond me. I thought that's unimaginable. But in our world, bourgeois society, it's possible to do that and get away with it. Not in the world of Jesus. You could not possibly do that without committing a kind of psychological suicide. So somehow to transcend that, because when the kids said they hated their parents, I knew really well what they meant. They could go hang out with their buds, and everything would be all right. They could somehow construct a life. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about finding my rootage, not in all of these blood relationships, but in this mystery that we call God. And to cut loose from, gradually, that foundational relationship, to seek my rootage in that mysterious other, is not an exaggeration to call that a kind of death. Let me just offer one more instance, which is also deeply rooted in the biblical tradition. We've got Global Crossing, WorldCom, Merrill Lynch, Xerox, Enron. I keep thinking of that terrifying line that Michael Douglas said quite confidently in the film Wall Street. Greed is good. Greed is good. And clearly, nobody even has to say that today because we take it for granted. The scandals, I mean, almost as frequent as the pedophilia scandal, as corporation after corporation admits to the most fraudulent, dishonest kind of behavior. Why? In the name of acquisition. Why? When is enough, enough? Enough for what? Enough for me to be somebody, I think. There has to be some profound need in the human psyche for people to be driven mindlessly by greed. And I think at its base, that greed is simply another way of self-constitution. I build my life. I am what I own. I am my world of possessions. And therefore, enough is never enough. There's a great song by Stephen Sondheim that he wrote for the musical Dick Tracy that Madonna sang called More. I don't know whether many of you know it. More. More. Two is good, four is better, four is better, eight is better, and what's better, best of all, is everything. Now we can kind of chuckle at that, a brilliant, brilliant libretto for that tune. But I see that in myself. I want to found myself, I want that kind of security. When I talk about security, I'm not talking about the vagaries of old age and hurricanes and earthquakes and tornadoes and all that stuff. I'm talking about me psychologically being secure. And to break out of that, okay, is clearly a kind of death. And I think it's important to remind ourselves of that because somebody has pointed out that there has not been the great hue and cry over against all those CEOs who made off like bandits. So Merrill Lynch pays a $100 million fine. Archer Daniel Midland's, you know, paid $500 million in fine for price fixing and all this, you know. But nobody gets all that exercise. And somebody has hypothesized that the reason that nobody gets too excited about that is that we all feel that if we were in those positions, we'd do pretty much the same thing. And I think that's very likely true of me. So what does the gospel, how does the gospel work? I can't say tomorrow I'm going to be Francis of Assisi. Just walk out my door, leave the house open, leave my art, my books, my CDs,
say goodbye and look for a begging bowl. I'm not going to do that. So what, in place of that, is that these texts offer us an alternate way of imagining the world and imagining our place. The image we have of ourselves and how we build ourselves is everything. We talk about the unimaginable, which means we just have removed something from even the realm of possibility. Well, what the gospel faces us with every time, if we listen, if we're not so domesticated that we can't hear it anymore, is to say the unimaginable is precisely what I need to imagine. You know? For me to find my sense of myself and my relationships with other human beings is rooted in the God who accepts us all. Therefore, I cannot say, well, my tribe or my family or my ethnic group or my race or my gender or whatever. None of that works. To imagine myself in that way, an unimaginable way, is I think what these readings can begin to start us undoing.